Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah, good evening. It's the Ellie Steele Show. And tonight I'm going to do something a little different, as we seem to do every Thursday night. But tonight I wanted to deliver an essay or read a lecture that was done by Manly P. Hall. And I'll just give you a little background on him. Manly P. Hall, born in 1901 and died in 1990, Canadian-born author and mystic. He's perhaps the most famous of his work. His most famous work is the Secret Teachings of All Ages, an encyclopedic outline of Masonic, Hermetic, Kabbalistic, and Rosicrucian symbolical philosophy. It was published in 1928 when he was 27 years old. Excuse me, I'm still getting over this damn cold and have a little cough here. But he was made a Knight Patron of the Masonic Research Group of San Francisco in 1953, and although he was not raised until November 1954 into the Jewel Lodge, numbers 374 in San Francisco, he later received his 32nd degree, and then in 1973, he was recognized as a 33 degree Mason. It's the highest, highest honor conferred by the Supreme Council of the Scottish Rite at a ceremony held at in his over 70-year career, Hall delivered approximately 8,000 lectures in the United States and abroad, and authored over 150 books and essays, and wrote countless magazine articles. The Philosophical Research Society he founded in Los Angeles, California, a nonprofit organization dedicated to the study of religion, mythology, metaphysics, and the occult. PRS maintains a research library of over 50,000 volumes and also sells and publishes metaphysical and spiritual books, mostly those authored by Hall. And what we have tonight, I want to thank my friend, our good friend, George Dixon, for sharing his work, this work with me. And he gave me a number of his lectures. And I wanted to read one tonight because I was very surprised, given background, which was so much of the occult. But some of his lectures are very fascinating, to say the least. They were fascinating, and one that caught me reviewed today, and I was quite surprised at the depth of this work. It was entitled "Jesus Wept," and coming from a Masonic scholar and whatever he was, I found this to be rather fascinating. And it kind of goes along with what we've been talking about we've been talking about in our past Thursday night shows regarding metaphysics and so on, and cover some ground that I've that fascinates me, but might enlighten some of our listeners tonight. I don't know if I'll be able to get through this entire work tonight. If not, I'll try to continue it next week. But it's not that long, but it may take a little more than an hour. What I may do is continue the reading, and then you can pick up the rest of it in the archive. But I'm going to start, and you take it as it is. Fascinating lecture, and essay, and we're going to begin. again, the title of it is Jesus Wept. And a rather unusual line of thinking on this subject was more or less inspired by the 35th verse of the 11th chapter of John, which contains the shortest verse in the Bible. Jesus wept. If this is just accepted as part of a narrative, I think it is overlooking the problems and mysteries which are really concealed in this apparently simple statement. In order to understand this verse a little better, the fact should be pointed out that the various symptoms of learning developed at different times in human history and in old days at the times of the beginning of things. Nearly every science was founded on allegories. They represented a simple statement of a visible, physical, or factual phenomenon, and then were interpreted by ensouling the words. Allegory was the phase of learning which did not explore the visible in order to understand the invisible. It rather took the point of view that true inner meaning came not from the circumstance itself, but from the intuitive internal power of the individual who is contemplating that circumstance. It was up to the human consciousness to ensoul facts, and until facts were ensouled, the central truths were not attainable. I'm having difficulty with my chat, getting my chat session on here. I'm sorry. Doesn't seem to be connecting. So if you're waiting there to say hello, or if you're joining us, bear with me until this thing works. Today, we explore the dimensions of time and space, but we do not call upon soul power to give meaning, value, moral, and integrity to the obvious physical occurrences. Everything we see is a symbol of something unseen, some power, some force, some principle operating in life. If we accept the visible without question, we are not likely to attain any depth of insight or to advance the cause of education. In Alexandria, in the early days, the great library of the Serapeion was among the wonders of the world. It was presided over by Serapis, whose image stood in the rotunda of the great library. Serapis was called the Sorrowing God, and was represented by an image of a very noble but grieving person, seemingly bowed down with some terrible internal tragedy. Perhaps it is the tragedy of human consciousness enthroned in the midst of worldly knowledge. There is a similar story told by Thomas de Quincey, who was sitting one day in the British Museum Library. When asked why he wept, de Quincey replied, "There is so much to learn in so little time. We have it today. Perhaps never in our history have we had more skills and more commodities, more facts with which to work than we have now. And perhaps in the world's orbit of life, we were never more miserable." This problem of the weeping god seems to call for a study in allegories. A research into the meanings by which we can take a simple narrative, whether it be factual or symbolical, and try to explore something of its inner meaning. In order to do this, we must use the power of meaning inside ourselves. Each individual must hold the light before the book he reads, for it is the light in him that will reveal whatever wisdom there may be in the book. We can review a bit some of the studies of antiquity which have a bearing upon this problem. We know, for example, that Plato wrote that birth into this world was death, and that the individual descending into the realm of matter, taking upon himself the mysterious vestments of the elements, came as near as any living thing can come to annihilation. That man could not be annihilated because there came with him into mortality an immortal principle within himself. As in the story of the awakening of the dead, he could sleep, but he could not truly completely die. And from the moment of his birth, the power within him began the labor of rescuing the personality from the involvement of error, fallacy, and tragedy. There was was always this power inside, which was the redeemer of the flesh. And if this power in man be lifted up, it will raise all other things unto itself. Thus Jesus, standing before the tomb of Lazarus, seems to tell us something of the relation of the soul to the body in all aspects of human thoughtfulness. The German mystic Boehme had a series of diagrams in his writings, which were transformed later into mannequins, or figures with movable parts. One of these mannequins shows, first of all, the solar system, lifting up one by one all the flaps by which the inner part of the diagram is concealed. One passes through the solar system, through the orbits of the planets, through the bands of elements, and finally, in the heart of the diagram, is the mysterious symbol of deity, which symbol is placed over the human heart. Antiquity regarded the heart, both literally and allegorically, as the seat of the divine principle in man. This heart, indeed, is the holy sepulcher, long in the hands of the infidel. The Crusades were a holy war to rescue this sepulcher. Muhammad writes that the greatest holy war is the conquest of self, and this in another form brings it all back to ourselves again. As Paul pointed out, the mystery of the Christ is not merely a historical circumference, nor is it a time separated from other times. It is not something highly significant 2,000 years ago, which can be now approached only in terms of history. Actually, the story is eternal, as contemporary today as it was then, and it will continue to guide and dominate human reflection for ages to come. This is because there is an element within the story that is timeless, the story of the triumph of integrity over ignorance, of life over death, spirit over worldliness. This struggle goes on, and we have to examine it in the light of this dimension of realization. What does it mean to us now that Jesus brought Lazarus forth from the grave? Another way of approaching it is in terms of the constitution of man himself. The ancients viewed the human being as a miniature of the universe. He was a microcosm, the little world, and in the little world, every factor, element, and part of the greater world is found in a compressed form, set forth for the wonderment of those who will seek to find it. The ancients believed that man derived his spirit from the stars, his soul from the planets, and his body from the elements, and this was the basis of the philosophical medical reasoning of Paracelsus von Hohenheim. And in his concept, man was a mysterious little world. And although he did not realize this fact as a little world, he was rather sufficient unto himself. This was because he was important, not because his personality would ever be sufficient, but because in his compound was the eternal principle of God, which was ever sufficient and could never lack anything that is necessary for the good of the creatures that exist. Pythagoras, the Greek philosopher, described the human soul as an octahedron, an eight-surfaced symmetrical solid. Of the eight the surfaces of the soul, seven were related to the sensory perceptions. From the sensory perceptions and from the power resident in the soul, which moved into manifestation through the senses, man secured the seven arts and sciences, the seven orders of architecture, the seven great compositions of music. He also received the seven cardinal virtues, and through the neglect and perversion of his psychic factors, he descended into the mystery of the seven deadly sins. And all these were septenaries. But there was an eighth power of the soul, and this was the power of the soul to generate, to give life, or to perpetuate. By that which generation witnesses comes into the mystery of regeneration, a new birth in time, a new birth in mystery, what the Egyptians called the mystery of the human soul coming forth by day out of the darkness of ignorance. And from the story of Lazarus, who was 4 days dead in the tomb, we have a presentation of the average human person, the person who has been dead for 4 days. Why is the term four used? Because death, in the philosophical sense, is embodiment in the four elements. It is significant that out of the four elements known to classical antiquity, all of the body structures and the psychological structure of the human being were created, and also, therefore, that this four-element structure has been called the personality. It is the person that presents itself to us, and it is also the person that most commonly presents itself to itself. This personality represents an equation with which the person can cope throughout his life. It binds him to matter, to a material structure, to the political, social, economic aspects of his daily existence. It binds him to the responsibilities of growth and development and the responsibilities of family, home, nation, and world. And the personality, therefore, represents that which of itself is not to be redeemed except by another power, a power that in the instance we are concerned with is personified by Jesus, but a power which actually is the Christ in you, the hope of glory. All change, all growth, all fulfillment has to come from within. And that which is within us all, as Plotinus points out, is the weeping God. It is that which in sorrow beholds the fallacies of the mind and the emotions, and yet is unable of itself to correct these fallacies unless dedication and personal effort result in the purification of the bodily vehicle. Therefore, those who seek truth must gradually rescue the innermost part of their own natures from the pressures of the body and the surrounding exterior environment. Again, we're discussing the lecture by Manly P. Hall, and I'm reading this. It was lecture number 253. He gave 8,000 lectures over that period. And he died in 1990. But I'll continue. We have then the story of the prisoner and the power that is locked within us all, a power which is a final source of all good that can come to the human being. It is the soul factor, which is of itself an aspect of the divine nature that descends from the world soul to be personified and embodied in the human soul. The body is substantially and essentially merely a revelation of the vitalities, energies, and formulas that create or form the soul itself. The ancient people in their doctrines of allegories were not content to accept the physical values of things as facts any more than they would have attempted to understand the nature of man himself by means of an autopsy. The search in ancient times was to discover meaning, purpose, and reason behind all that happens in the world. Man can be said to be the analogous to a word with body for consonants and soul for vowels, and it is this power within that dominates or invigorates all the aspects of man's personality. In considering this, a little more intimately, we have to consider what brings about the final release of the soul locked in man, the mysterious psyche that is held within the prison of the corporal constitution. This soul power is what Bohème refers to as a seed. It is the seed of the tree of everlastingness. It is a magnificent root, rooted in eternity and bringing forth its fruit in time. This soul seed concept is also found in Eastern religions. It is found throughout the world, for as surely as man grows from infancy to maturity physically, so the soul, through a process of growth and unfoldment, reveals its own ultimate purpose by degrees. In order to accommodate, in order to accomplish this, however, it is necessary that the soul be permitted to become the leader of the flesh. If the flesh continues to betray the soul, then it comes again to the tragedy of Calvary. So, in other words, as we betray ourselves, we continually, more or less, crucify ourselves by betraying ourselves. And a Rosicrucian book, which we have in the library, shows the crucifixion inside of the human heart. In another work, probably of Mennonite origin, the glorified Christ is placed within a heart. The heart is, therefore, this mysterious center. It is the temple, the holy altar. It is that matchless altar upon which blazes forever the light of human salvation. And the heart being as it is, but the physical expression of the invisible, moral, psychic, spiritual heart, it becomes obvious that the redemption of the heart is not a physical problem for medical skill, which deals only with its physical aspects. The heart, like the Septafona cave in India, where Buddha initiated his apostles, with seven rooms, which again relates to the nature of the soul. It is through the heart that the invisible light of the visible body is sustained, and as long as the drum of Shiva continues its pulse, man lives. And from the pulse, according to the Chinese physician, all ailments of the flesh can be diagnosed and most of them can be treated. The soul, then, has to achieve its victory over the ignorance, superstition, and fear by which we are usually dominated. The heart, to be brought to this level, must be recognized, its needs must be understood, and the individual who seeks to live the better life, who seeks the saving grace of his faith, must become a proper servant of this soul structure within himself. He must release into manifestation the pure light of soul power. We accomplish this in various ways, and one link between the objective and the soul is prayer. We often wonder how it happens that one supreme being, diffused among all the infinite factions and factors of existence, can listen to each prayer. It listens to each prayer because the divine principle is within each of us, and in prayer we enter the closet of the heart and we pray in secret, and that which hears the secret rewards us openly. The whole problem can be reduced to a phenomena relating to the conscious experience of identification with the soul power within ourselves. Prayer is a bridge. It is a link leading into the core of our own lives, and in so doing, mingles itself with the soul life and the soul light of all other ensouled creatures. Prayer, like the soul, has no boundaries. It is something that is available by a conditioning process, and the individual who adds his prayer to the prayers of others actually only releases his own support into a prayerfulness that is infinite and without boundary. Prayer in itself, however, as it is used today by the average person, is not really, for the most part, a realization of this mystery. It is addressed to some separate being, asking for mercy or assistance, in too many cases merely for the fulfillment of ambitions and appetites. True prayer is actually a speaking to the innermost. It is a turning of words into a root of words. A turning of thought into a very foundation and fountainhead of thought. It is a reinstatement, or a restatement rather, of ideals, in which the ideals, as we express them, actually release the soul power that is behind all ideals. And soul power, I mean S-O-U-L, power of the soul, that is behind all ideals. As we go on with this, we come to other forms of discipline, for we realize that when the time comes to transfer allegiances from the world to God, we must accept inevitable consequences. We cannot serve two masters. And when the time comes that inwardly we realize that we must serve truth and truth alone, this is a tremendous decision. It is a decision that must be supported by as much release of soul content as is possible for us to attain. For this point of view, then, we think of other disciplines, one of which is a meditational approach to life. Meditation is a kind of internal thoughtfulness about realities. It consists of the person gradually escaping from the superficial attitudes of the conscious mind and centering attention upon the eternal verities of internal life itself. Meditation is therefore a continuing realization of the presence of the deity in the human heart. Mandalas and the various other meditation symbols are merely pictures of man's archetypal estimation of the relationships between the various parts of his own nature. He is forever striving to align himself with the best and the good, but when he would do good, evil is ever nigh unto him. He finds it very difficult to live the life of the spirit in a world controlled by mundane ambitions and pressures. Meditation, however, results in quietude, and the soul's abode is an abode of quietude. No one can ever find the soul except he experienced the peace of the soul. This peace of the soul has also been referred to as the kiss of God, and it represents the end of all antagonism, all conflicts, all uncertainty, all ulterior motives. This searching for the innermost of ourselves comes finally to the problem of peacefulness. We must realize, as one poet put it, that man is never less alone than when alone. And to reach this condition of a consciousness, every human being must pass through this Gethsemane. It is part of his journey inward, and the whole life in the New Testament Gospels is the story of the journey inward, the search of the lonely for that which is forever alone. Now, having gone into the problem of the quietude of things, we then come to a point of reversal. We come to the point where soul power begins to be positive, where the internal flows outward. Up to the present time, most of our knowledge is derived from the outside. Most of our encouragement comes from others, and most of our ideas and purposes are derived from the traditions of our kind. But there comes a moment, and this is where the principle of allegory justifies itself completely, when the direction turns and the individual does not gain his sight, his insights from the outside, but from within himself. He suddenly discovers that the knower is within his own, that education is the way or the means of the knowing thought of that which is eternal within the self. Within the human soul are the foundations of all arts and sciences, all creeds and codes, all achievements, all accomplishments, and through the soul, all forms of learning are brought to fruition. If we want to understand the universe, we must first discover the soul, and through the soul experience our identification on various levels with everything that exists. At this turning point, we find that our leadership passes from the truth of this world, which have nothing in God, to the soul, which is the quotient of reality within our own natures. The enlightened soul, released from bondage to ignorance, brings this forth as the cosmic Messiah. It is the source of all good, the secret of everlasting life, the victory of life over death, of ignorance no longer controlling the conduct of the individual. Now, this wisdom of the soul is something very different to understand, for the reason that it is not a specific form of wisdom. It is not something that a textbook could be written about, but an experience of the full insight into things. The soul is not concerned with the textbook of science, because actually the soul is superior to the text. It knows where the text gropes from knowledge and understanding. This understanding of the soul is not limited to particulars, but is a genuine and general inclusion of all of the truth of the thing, its total substance, its total nature, and at the same time its total need. Gradually, then, the soul has given us what we have of civilization. What we know as true progress is nothing but the gradual releasing of soul power. What we look forward to with such great hope of the future, the utopian dream that we have, arise from the heart's yearnings after peace, security, and spiritual atonement with divinity. This line of thinking leads us inevitably toward the reversal of our source of knowledge. In absolute stillness and a complete detachment from all worldliness, by complete resignation to the power of the soul and the self, the individual suddenly finds that the light of the soul begins to stream out and flow outward through the individual, transforming him into a soul creature. Again, that's S-O-U-L, creature. Each person, therefore, will become in due time capable of all those works that are associated with Christ and greater labors even than he performed. Today we have great problems. We have problems on every level of our living, in our homes, in government, in relationships. We have problems of pain, confusion, worry, fear, anxiety. We have all kinds of problems, and for thousands of years we have been trying to change the world so these problems would not exist. We have had dreams of a problemless age in which all things necessary will be available. But the only way this can happen does not lie in changing everyone else's minds. The solution of all problems lies within our own individual inner lives. World confusion ends when it ends for us. It ends when we understand through it, when we ensoul the problem, we find the reason and the solution. When our own consciousness is capable of visualizing and ensouling the world problem, that problem also will be solved. In the meantime, we can work on the situation of our own lives. So in other words, I think if we solve our own problems, we've solved the problems of the world. I'm glad to, I'm just reading your message, Cryptic, and I appreciate that. Let me continue here. Jesus told his disciples to go forth and in his name to heal the sick, raise the dead, cast out demons, and cleanse the leper. He gave his disciples, therefore, the authority of the great home house cleaning, from the opening of the eyes of the blind to the multiplication of the loaves and fishes. All of these miracles have social significance, immediate significance in our own lives. Today we are worried about our natural resources. We do not know what we are going to do. We are encroaching more and more upon the natural environment. We are corroding endangered species. We are afraid that we won't be able to take care of the physical needs of the billions of people who have come into this world. Here we have the mystery of the loaves and the fishes of the soul as it takes control of society's will. Will perform the miracle of feeding the multitudes and having enough left for 12 baskets. It is the soul that determines use and the lack of soul that causes abuse. While abuse lasts, there will be famines in the world. When the soul governs conduct, there will be food for all. It is a change of attitudes. The improvement of character is the great solver of problems. And who can be so blind as those who can live in this world, grow up and function in it, be surrounded by the wonders and mysteries of the natural world and the amazing achievements of the human mind, and learn nothing? Going out of this world as they came in, they leave without respect for the values with which they have lived and which have protected them, in many cases, through the years of life. And every materialist in Ma is blind. Any individual who can look out over nature and not sense and see inwardly that which is nature's God, who can examine the universe and come out convinced that it is nothing but a machine is blind. The individual who does not count his own blessings is blind. It is the soul that opens the eyes of the consciousness to behold that which is good, to be grateful, and to understand and to serve with diligence. As to those of whom it is said demons had inhabited them and were to be cast out of them, each of us has our own little demonology working with us all the time. We are full of sprites, dragons, monstrosities of one nature or another, grim and fearful specters, and nearly every human mind is a haunted house. Why? Because these demons ourselves witness greed, envy, criticism, and spreading of false doctrines, the corruption and perversion of knowledge, the exploitation of ambitions, the tyranny of our own willpower. All of these are little monsters that infest us, and because they are in most of us in fair quantity, they infest the whole world. All of these attitudes are like various germs and bacteria that corrupt life. Thus, to cast out demons or to cast out evil spirits is to cast out the evil in our own spirit, to cast out forever the negative and corrupt values which we have permitted to dominate our thinking and dominate our attitudes. The raising of the dead involved directly with the Lazarus story is perhaps one of the most important of all parables, for it is not only represents the problem of the miracles as attributed to Jesus, but presents perhaps one of the most magnificent possibilities that man can ever imagine, namely, that the complete control of the personality by its own higher nature could possibly prolong the existence of the body indefinitely. If the spirit controls the soul interacts, and the soul interacts, the normal function of the body restored can extend over hundreds of years, whereas today we spend so long creating a body and then an equal length of time tearing it down. So we actually have the power to be immortal or to live forever. Yes, little monsters and little nasties all live within us. And, and as they live in us, they live in the world. And it's a fascinating thing. But let's see how we can get rid of this. These nasties. This brings another point into focus. The instruction of Jesus to heal the sick. Naturally, the first sickness that we face is our own. And our own sickness is due in almost every case to some type of ignorance or rebellion against the truth. Sickness is the result of the inability of the inner life to transmute external pressures or to overcome the debilities of the environment in which we live. Actually, the individual who transforms his own life and lives with a full conviction that the way of the Spirit is the way of life, lives with a full conviction that the way of the Spirit is the way of life, can make great and wonderful changes in his own nature. Faith healing has always been, to a degree at least, part of the Christian ministry. Prayer, healing, and healing through dedications, devotions, and through the renunciation of various types of misdemeanors are processes which have not only been perpetrated in Christendom, but exist in practically all the other world religions. The great achievement is not the faith to which one belongs, but the faith to which one lives. If this faith is stronger than uncertainty, the benefits to the whole and complete person become immediately obvious. Therefore, each of us is a field in which all of the gospel ministry may be applied, and we should make these accomplishments part of our own lives. If you can imagine yourselves to be a great seer, a great enlightened teacher, and you stood as Jesus stood, looking out over the city of Jerusalem, you might understand his sadness when he reached out his arm over the city and realized that he could not change the way of that people. He could not force the world to virtue. He could only hope for all things, pray for all things, and make the supreme sacrifices of his own life for the common good. But the world would still go on burdened with the miseries of world conditions. There would be the continuation, as we see it now, generation after generation of corruption. It would be very difficult for anyone to understand life as Jesus understood it and not weep. Weeping, according to one of the Greek philosophers, had a special significance. It is said to be a badge of virtue. A philosopher found weeping was asked why he wept, and he said, "I weep for the death of my son." The man who spoke to him said, "Well, weeping will do no good." The old man broke into tears afresh and said, "It is because it does no good that I weep so seriously." That weeping does no good in one of the tragedies of life, and yet that tragedy is summarized in glory. The whole Christian ministry is a ministry of upgraded hopes. It is a realization that at the end of the great course of life, all that is good will come, and it will come because, in a strange way, the life of Jesus welcomed the path, the key, the personal way in which almost all of these accomplishments must be made. It is not necessary for us to think in terms of a physical crucifixion, nor is it necessary for us to assume that all the hardships and burdens will be just like those found in the Gospels. But the fact remains that the beginning of the Christian ministry was declaration and self-sacrifice. It was the individual willing to give all in order to protect his own soul, to make of himself a voice crying out in the wilderness, a willingness to die rather than to compromise principles, and a definite determination to dedicate life to unselfish labors of good. I don't know if I could do it personally. I don't know if I could give up that, death to compromise. I think I'd be rather quick to compromise, depending on what it is, of course. But yeah, in this case, I don't know. It poses a good question, though. Do we have the courage to maintain truth and keep looking for truth at all costs? I don't know. In the story of Lazarus, we also have a little epilogue, an allegorical play written by Eugene O'Neill called Lazarus Laughed. This is an imaginary account of what happened to Lazarus after he had been raised from the dead. It finally ended when Lazarus went to Rome and was condemned to death in the arena. Every effort was made by the Romans to frighten Lazarus, to cause him to recant, to give up his faith, to renounce his principles on the fear of death. If he did not do what he was told, they would kill him. And Lazarus laughed. He said, "Death can have no part in my consciousness. I have died, and I have lived again. Therefore, I can no longer fear death." This is a very interesting story with an allegorical foundation, telling us something more about the mystery of life, and revealing to us all that once we have died and been reborn in spirit, the fear of death is gone forever. Death itself is a fear, a fallacy, and a fault. It is part of that uncontrollable negation with which the world is afflicted. We should look into the nature of the soul a little more carefully. What is the soul in man? What is it? Why is it a sorrowing God? I think the answer is very obvious, namely that the soul really carries within it the embodiment of the previous life experiences of the individual. The soul is a seed coming into birth, taking possession of the body it at quickening, when it begins to function through the entity, though the entity is unprepared for. It comes into this life and immediately environment begins to mold it. Heredity affects it through the bloodstream and through the descent of endocrine and chemical resources. Early training influences it. World careers come in to make things more complicated. Disappointments, failures, animosities, antagonisms, bad examples, all of these things bring to burden the mind with intensive attitudes. And these intensive attitudes gradually become the controlling force in life. Emotions take over, the mind takes over, energy resources take over, and these together turn their most negative aspects upon the physical body. And in the meantime, that which we really came to do remains undone. Paracelsus tells us that there were five elements, not four, and the fifth element was ether, or Azoth, and the mysterious ether, a strange symbol of the superior power above and beyond the elements. It was in this element of ether that the universal medicine of alchemy was created. It was here that the four elements were controlled by a mysterious energy source which, if it were lifted up, would raise all the elements into unity with it. This fifth element became to the ancients the means, the energy field, by which the other elements could be redeemed. It was a subtle force above vitality. It was a kind of elemental energy which could function even when the spirit structures were corrupted, and it was this true energy which to the ancients made possible the redemption of the elements of the body. This fifth element was the soul-infused element. It was an aspect of the soul itself, that aspect which is primarily associated with generation. The soul, according to the Greeks, was a spiritual center, a manifestation of the divine. It was, however, a middle distance twixt heaven and earth, a dominion welding. It was a bridge that bound the personality to the divine, across which the divine manifested its purposes, its morals, and its energies to the world. The soul was that part of the compound which was implanted in man when he became a living being, and it was that part of him which would ultimately be his redeemer. He may delay his redemption for a long time, but ultimately the soul will win. It will transform, it will transmute, it will in every way renovate the purpose of mankind. The soul is the root of true progress, a progress which is not possible without enlightenment and dedication. The soul is the final victory of realities over illusions. The power of the soul helps man to awaken from the dreaming of his own isolation, and also will give him the courage to open his eyes and escape the nightmares with which his common emotional life is infested. The soul is a particular substance. It is something in itself. It is not merely a word. It is something which, like light, carries within itself all of the psychic colors. As the light is broken up by a spectrum, so the soul light is broken up by a spectrum. The soul light is invisible to the mortal eye. Paracelsus said that there were three suns in the solar system: the spiritual sun, the sun of the soul, and the bodily sun. The one we see is the bodily sun. The other two are invisible, but each sustains a part of man's compound nature. And the soul sun or psychic sun is the messianic sun. It is the power which vitalizes and maintains and energizes the ideals, the integrities, and the aspirations of the individual. So essentially, that soul sun or psychic sun is Christhood, is the Christ within us, which we all have. The Greeks said that the soul is a perfectly harmonious structure, that there is no dissonance or asymmetry anywhere within its nature. In all parts, it is equal to itself, and it receives and distributes like the facets of diamonds, the divine power itself. Having become, so to say, the seat of man's morality, integrity, and aesthetics, according to Populus and Plotinus, the soul is of the nature of beauty and manifests as a power of good. It is that which venerates, that which is worthy of veneration, that which humbles itself before that which is greater than itself. It also rejoices in the likeness of itself. The soul, because it is beautiful in all of its parts, the soul of nature has created the landscape. It has created the mountains and the valleys, the flowers and the birds, and has made all of these things beautiful, or, as the scriptures say, good. And the soul, beholding good, is ravished by it, flowing from itself to recognize and venerate the beautiful and the good. And this form of veneration may be art, for in art, the individual, beholding the beauty of the world, attempts from within itself, or within himself, to express and interpret this beauty. The soul ensouls all other areas, but always it stands for balance, moderation, excellence of all kinds, and the perfect harmony and sympathy. Consequently, whenever the soul perceives in anything exterior to itself these qualities which are its own, it rushes forth to embrace them, and the individual, beholding beauty, rejoices in beauty, beholding virtue, admires virtue. Admiration is only the soul's registering satisfaction for something it has discovered and known about and become one with. It follows that the soul, because of these qualities, must be indeed deeply saddened when it beholds the failure of life to simply fulfill its own natural and simple course. I think most of the ancients recognize the danger that has come into the world is largely the result of intellect. The mind begins the development of ulterior motives, and we have the struggle between knowledge and insight. This may have something to do with the story of Eden and the tree of knowledge. In any event, it has to do with the concept that knowledge is different from allegory. Knowledge is an accumulation of available facts, but not the interpretation of them. And knowledge is the extension of our ability to explore from the flat surface of material values. Knowledge enables us to store up vast accumulations of facts, attitudes, ideas, figures, and statistics. But knowledge, the individual can become truly a great computer, and he can also invent the computer, for it is certainly an invention of the mind. The mind, as Lord Bacon points out, is a treacherous thing because it is forever self-justifying. In order to prove it was right, it commits further errors, of which perhaps the most common is that having proved it cannot win a war, it starts another. Yet all these things have to do with a kind of subtle factuality that has nothing of truth itself. But the power of this factual fulfillment of personal ambition has deceived the individual and the world for thousands of years, because according to facts, it is assumed that we become educated. This is not true. We can have all the facts in the world and die miserably. We can be the wisest of mortals and suffer from a broken home. All material accumulations of knowledge and skill are comparatively treacherous unless they are ensouled. Unless a great spiritual motivation takes control of conduct, whatever we do remains a potential menace. Einstein realized this in connection with his researches in nuclear fission. And he pointed out that the terrible dangers of knowledge producing universal catastrophe. The problem of man's catastrophe is in himself, his personal life, brought down by knowledge, because knowledge has not received the benefit of grace. Knowledge, like the sinner, is not to be redeemed without proper baptism, and the baptism of knowledge is the ensouling of it, and the bringing it into the service of divine principle. If we want to grow as the sages of old, we will realize the tragedy of man. We have persecuted the prophets from the beginning and destroyed those who sought to bring us hope and faith and understanding. The various teachers have been very difficult and disillusioning lives. Jesus was crucified. Muhammad was poisoned. Zoroaster had a spear in his back. These teachers and and many others suffered from the simple desire to serve. One of the last remarks of Confucius was, "I have failed." All this pain, this tremendous resistance to good, can only bring sorrow to those who understand. Perhaps Christ wept as a parent weeps who cannot change the conduct of a wayward child, a grief based upon the realization of what could be, the magnificence that is hidden, the inability to break through self-centeredness and rescue the human being from the prince of this world. Everywhere this dream has been recognized, and everywhere it has been served. George Bernard Shaw wrote a very interesting play called St. Joan, and the life of Joan of Arc. In that play, someone says, "You canonized her. She is dead and you canonized her. What would you do if she were reborn?" And the answer was, "Burn her at the stake again." And dead, you can canonize her safely. Alive, she was a danger to the prejudices and self-policies of mankind. We have always the great sadness that comes from the inevitable realization that the more we love, the more we suffer at the sorrows of others. It is something that transcends our personal disasters, and we have to finally come to the same end that St. Francis of Assisi recognized and realized, that the blessed privilege, the blessed reward, is the reward to love and not to reward, and not the reward of being loved in return. Everywhere the soul suffers at the perversions of its own house, it has seen in ancient sorrows the temples of gods fade away in dust. It has seen the temple on Mount Moriah desecrated. It has seen the temple of the human heart on the great mountain of the diaphragm desecrated. It has seen all the things that are good sacrificed to small and unimportant matters in our silence. It is not unreasonable that we find the soul to be saddened. We are bound to be sad until we are right. We are bound to suffer even though we understand. And our natural feelings of sympathy for suffering are part of the soul power also, and sometimes it is this type of feeling of suffering that brings us to the surface of others in a miraculous and enlightened way. To the old biblical thinkers, baptism was an awakening. It was bringing to the consciousness the spiritual life of the individual. Jesus called forth Lazarus and told him to go on and go back to his life. He brings about this miracle by a prayer to his Father and by speaking as the soul itself, and the Father justifies and makes possible the work. It is not the person, the Messiah himself, but his Father who does the work. Here we have, I think, a very important phase of the whole matter, that we finally learn that there is only one real power in life, and that it is divine power. And those who serve it faithfully may address their prayers hopefully to it. They may realize that that which we serve will in a strange and wonderful way preserve them, not against the evils caused by men, but against the evils which arouse within themselves. Jesus healed by the power of the Father. He performed all his miracles by the power of the Father, by the one power of life. Actually, all of us, no matter how we may feel about it, are children dependent upon one divine strength. Therefore, whatever we accomplish in life, it is the Spirit that does the work. Now, I have about 1 minute remaining, 1.5 minutes or so. I'm going to try to get this through this, because I've only got a couple paragraphs left. But if not, I'll finish it tonight, and you can pick it up in the afterwards. I've got just one more minute, and I'm going to continue with this. And thanks, Cryptic, for being with me tonight. I appreciate it. And to the... what is it? Everywhere... I think I'm... to the old biblical thinkers, baptism was an awakening. We think of this only in terms of the miraculous, but let us think of it also in terms of the everyday. When the individual prays to God, it is the Father who does the work. When he comes home and sits down to dinner, it is the heavenly power that has accomplished the mystery of food. And as we go about our tasks, the banker, the broker, the candlestick maker, all all of us are carrying on our activities because of one life, one power. This power we have chained to our physical ambitions as the Philistines chained Samson to the mill wheel. We are now taking all of the universal powers and energies of life and applying them only to our own purposes. We think that this life, then, is maybe like some kind of stellar electricity, which we turn on and off at will, and that there are no moral values involved, no reason why we should be concerned over what we do. Actually, this is not true. We are all not only concerned, but responsible in everything that we do, and the expenditure of the divine energy moving in on us, we are accountable for. Every action created a karma of some kind. And everything that we do well is a reward and is rewarded. And everything that we do wrong is penalty and is penalized. Thus, we are all working with one life. It is in ourselves, it is in our neighbor, it is in our friend and our enemy. It is in those who disagree with us as much as those who do agree. It is something that binds us all together in an indissoluble pattern of common responsibility and common need. Therefore, it is part of our proper growth, manifestation, and fulfillment that we work together and strive forever to discover these identities, which alone can restore the realization of the brotherhood of mankind. The brotherhood of mankind is a soul phenomenon, and mutual hatreds and animosities are mental and emotional phenomena. They are wrong and without benefit of the needed enlightenment within ourselves. The Greek concept was to let the soul lead and the rest follow. The soul is the mysterious power that must be obeyed, and if it is disobeyed, it is a form of treason against life, against truth, and heresy against God. So settle down to the cultivation of the best within ourselves is important. Several of the early scholastic teachers taught us that the conscience is the voice of the soul, that to disobey or disregard conscience creates misery. When we do that which we know is not right, when we project a project in which we know that the internal life within us is not in agreement, then we indeed are false witnesses to the life that sustains us all. We must make peace with ourselves, with the internal, for this is the beginning of our experience of the eternal. We must all of us try the best we can every day to make sure that the Christ within us is liberated from the sorrow of its ancient ministry, so that we can change the weeping God to the God of joy in our own hearts. When we do this, regardless of the faith to which we belong, we are keeping faith with that which is eternal. That season of the year, when we are concerned largely with resurrection, offers a good opportunity for us to allow our own spiritual content to rise victorious over the self-centeredness of our materialistic thinking. Not only do we want to strive to know, we want to know only what we may become better, that we may become better. And to become better means to release more soul power through conduct. If we can follow this pattern quietly, simply, gently, lovingly, we will come in due time to a good harvest. This was the promise of the ages, and it is fulfilled inevitably because it is here. It always has been here. It is a part of the immortal being that departs from bodies at death, returns to them at birth, and continues to be born until it becomes the sovereign of all that lives. And that's the end of that lecture. And it's called Jesus Wept by Manly P. Hall. And I hope you enjoyed that. And thank you for listening. Tomorrow night we have George Gibson with us, and we'll be talking more about this issue and possibly how we'll talk about Manly's works, since George was the one who gave me all of these lectures. And That's it. So I thank you all for those of you who listened tonight, and I hope you had a good time, and hope you'll be with us tomorrow night right here, same time.